Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. And we're going to march forward in the ever-expanding exploration of the cultures of consciousness. One of the many fascinating things about the dealings in the Islamic, in particular Arab world, over the last few months, in addition to just a fascinating, unexpected explosion of novelty and political possibility in an area and in a set of places that we often think of as being pretty stressed without a lot of room for freedom. In addition to all that was just the way that I think it forced a lot of people in the West to reconsider, re-engage, open up their sense of not just the Arab world, but the Muslim world in general. I remember I had a very interesting conversation with Alan Bishop, who runs a record label called Sublime Frequencies that sort of plays or collects all unusual world music, and we'll have him on the show sometime this summer. He's a fascinating fellow, and he's half Lebanese, and we were talking about the kind of unconscious racism even that people have around, again, both Arabs and Muslims in general. And I had to recognize that even in myself, I had a little bit of the sense of, like, rather than immediately seeing this opening of positivity and freedom, even if things in Egypt and clearly other places are not going to go, swimmingly necessarily, I remember feeling even a little bit of fear or concern just at the possibility of the openness of the unknown. And I think a lot of people found that, and also realized that that it's time, as we plunge forward into this crazy, crazy, crazy century, that all identities, all cultures must keep a sort of faith in the openness of possibility, even when we can see very crushing forces out there, so that even when we think about Islam and even when we think about reactionary Islam, it's always important to recognize that everything is a moving target now. And I mean, maybe that's too military a metaphor, but everything is open-ended, and part of the work is to constantly keep that space of possibility open and not fall into kind of congealed, cartoonish, TV news level of assumptions about what's going on in countries, in people's hearts, in religions. And one of the ways of doing that is to just find out more stories, talk to more people, individual stories, stories that people have their own encounters one way or the other, because the reality on the ground is always more complex and rich and engaging and interesting than the kind of political cartoons we often allow to dominate our brains. And so it's kind of with that spirit of just wanting to find out some really interesting personal stories and how they manifest in art and spirit, that I'm really happy to have Ariana Delawari on the show today. But before we talk to Ariana, I'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, you are the one who had the idea of bringing Ariana onto the show, and I'm just wondering if you could just say how you met her, or why you were interested in her work.
Yeah, sure. I met her through, she came to some of my lectures and events and stuff, and we know a lot of the same people, so it was like a communal kind of meeting. And then just through talking to her, actually, I got to know her through talking about ancestor stuff. You know, because she, as an individual, like you said, finding out about these stories, is an individual who's from, Afghanistan, and has a relationship with her family and her culture and her community. So when a lot of people think about, like, the Taliban or Afghanistan, we only, like, in America, they'll have, like, a terrorist vision. But they forget that there's, like, people that live in Afghanistan, like, in cities and villages, and they have families and history there. You know, that country is very, very old, and it goes back a long way. So it's actually through talking about, like, literally grandparents, and we found out we have, our grandmas have the same name, Pauline, which I thought was pretty magical. And just, like, that experience of going through these cultural political episodes through an entire family and community of people, and the way she does it through her music and films and stuff like that, I find her very inspiring. So I'm really glad she's on the show.
Excellent. Well, with no further ado, let's bring Ariana on. Hi, Ariana. You there?
Yeah. Can you hear me? I'm sorry about my cell phone. I'm running around.
That's okay. As long as we don't lose signal, we'll live with it. We don't mind.
Okay.
So, you know, I think that, I mean, there's a lot of things we can talk about, but I'd love just to hear a little bit, just to, you know, tell listeners a little bit about your interesting kind of family situation and what led you as a, you know, as a musician, to return to, or to go to Afghanistan, and just that kind of personal story. I mean, it's just such a rich and unexpected kind of engagement with that place.
Yeah, sure. Well, actually, I was born in Los Angeles. My father is from Afghanistan. My mom is half Afghan and half Sicilian, and she was born in New Jersey and went to Afghanistan in her early 20s because she had such a fascination with her father's culture, and went there and met my dad, and they were just friends, you know, when she was over there at first, but then, you know, she left, he was totally sad, and he went to study economics in London, and like, I guess it was a few years later after they met that she was meeting him up in London, and they ended up getting married, and they moved here in, like, 1970, and I was born in 1980. I was born, like, right after, maybe 6 months after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So I was born at a time when there was sort of a transition going on in our household, because my father had been a banker, my mom was, she had, like, a toy shop, and they had this very suburban life, and I have two older sisters, and we lived in La Cunada, this very, like, suburban, quiet town, very California town, and I was born, like, when everything shifted for us, and a lot of my relatives, like my cousins and aunts and uncles, all left Afghanistan and were living in our house for a while they were getting their lives started here. So I was literally, they came October 1st, and I was born October 21st, so our house was just a constant Afghan party, like live music and relatives. It was like a celebration. I think because it was really important for there to be a celebration here for them, and a reminder of home, because they had left so much, and it, you know, sure, it was really different to be here. And so that's what I grew up in. So I kind of, even though I was in this, you know, it was like Farsi was actually my, or Dari, Afghan speaks Dari, but it's really my first language. I wasn't even speaking English yet, because I was surrounded by all of these Afghans, even though I was in this La Cunada home. And then, I music has always been a big passion of mine, and I started playing guitar when I was like 12, and I mean, my obsession was always like Hendrix and like John Lennon and stuff. I remember I was like 14 and I went to see Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, and it was the No Quarter Tour, and they had all these Moroccan musicians. And I had this feeling at that age, like, I really want to record in Afghanistan someday and like play music with Afghan musicians. And I was like really little, and this before 9/11 or anything. I just had this like desire to do that. Then when things shifted so much, and you know, and after the, I was in film school at the time of 9/11. Like my whole, I should actually back up. My whole life, my dad had this political call regarding Afghanistan. In addition to, you know, his banking work here, he was constantly doing stuff for Afghanistan from here. as a kid, I've got to admit, I really did not think anyone was listening. And I remember thinking, God, why does Dad put so much time into this? Like, you know, it's like all these other aspects of his life, like we don't even get to see him enough sometimes because his passion is Afghanistan and no one even knows where it is on a map. And then 9/11 happened when I was in film school and it just changed our lives forever. Like, all of a sudden it was like this thing that we knew so much about and the world didn't know yet and weren't really listening. So, I mean, up until that point, when Afghans here and all over the world were trying to warn, you know, whether it was the U.S. government or whatever government, you know, whatever country they were living in, there were a lot of Afghans trying to warn people about what the situation, about what's happening in Afghanistan. No one was listening. 9/11 happens and all of a sudden everyone's listening. But we had seen this country completely, you know, devastated after the Soviet withdrawal and the civil war that happened within the country and then the Taliban. This was years. It took years for all of this stuff to happen. So while the rest of the world thinks that this notion of terrorism just sort of surfaced after 9/11, this has been, like, building. It's been, like, you know, this foreign policy, not just, you know, between the U.S. and Afghanistan, but all over the world, the U.S. and other countries amongst themselves, like, there has been this kind of stuff has been building. And I think that people who understand those parts of the world have been watching this for decades. So,
well, it's also just history. You know, it's like our culture and our media, even though we're reading about current events, they don't tend to put them in a historical context. In fact, they actually avoid it a lot of the time because history is messy. History is complicated.
Right.
History is grim in a lot of ways. But when you have that kind of more personal connection or through your family, you know, then you're history's in your living room, like you say, when they showed up, there's all this Afghan culture, but it's displaced. But I'm just curious about you when you were growing up. How did you identify in terms of, like, I'm a Californian or I'm American, but I'm also this, or how were those worlds brought together in your life?
It's funny. I think because my parents were so open-minded. I mean, my family is very diverse. My parents on both sides, my dad's brothers and sisters, my mom's brothers and sisters married into many different cultures. I have cousins all over the world of every ethnicity and every religion. And, you know, I just grew up like this, you know, very diverse family. So I think that definitely has an impact on my parents and how I was raised. And because they didn't force Afghanistan on me, I mean, I knew other young Afghans whose parents were like, you can't do that because you're Afghan. Like, you know, my parents were not like that. They were like, you're Ariana, and you can do what you feel is right. And I think that's why I was able to have so much love for my culture, because I was able to be a girl growing up in L.A. and do everything that, you know, and be, and I'm definitely very American as well. I am absolutely very American. I also grew up on, like, you know, old country music too. So it's like not like, you know, not like one thing, but because of how much passion my parents both have for their culture and our culture, I was exposed to a lot. And so, you know, when just sort of, I don't know, sort of like a natural progression, it was that I had been an artist my whole life and cared about my culture and grew up in this house where I was exposed to a lot of politics. And it was just this natural progression that, like, when 9/11 happened, my parents moved to Afghanistan. They, like, sold everything here and moved back to help with the reconstruction process. And
coming from that place of freedom that you come from, Ariana, and that kind of open-mindedness, I know that, like, you went back, after your parents moved back, you actually went back, if I'm correct, to record music there in Afghanistan at a time when it was banned. So can you talk about, like, what happened to you coming from that kind of place of freedom and open-mindedness once you actually went back to a country that was really not free at all in those ways?
Yeah, so I had been going there since 2002, and I just I started by documenting in photographs and film and totally fell in love with everything. And then it was a natural progression that it became part of my music as well. It wasn't actually banned when I went. When starting in like, two, I guess it was like February, of, I remember it was like right after 9/11 when U.S. troops went over there and there was a sort of shift in, and the, this new democracy was sort of born there. That's when music was actually not banned anymore, and you know, women didn't have to cover their faces, and all of these sort of laws of the Taliban were not laws anymore. There are areas and provinces and stuff that I'm sure that they still were living under those regulations out of fear or out of habit or out of whatever, but it wasn't ever Afghan culture. It was just, if you read more about the Taliban, you can find out these sort of arbitrary laws that they implemented as part of their regime. When I went, it was starting to become a dangerous time though when I went. In 2007, there had been quite a few suicide bombings, which I didn't see from like 2002 until 2004 or 2005. It was actually really progressing. It was a really wonderful, amazing thing to see. And a lot of Afghans who returned or expats or, foreigners who have been there know that it was a very exciting and rare window of time.
Hello. Hey, I think we lost our guest there, Maja.
Did she disappear?
That's the problem with the cell phones, man. They give and they take away.
They're such a tease.
So I don't know. Hopefully, our engineer will give her a ring as we're chatting here. You know, it's funny. A lot of what she was saying reminded me of my the fellow I was talking about at the beginning of the show, Alan Bishop, because they grew up in this mixed household, and just talking to them about they were like fans of they were listening to Ted Nugent, and then every Saturday they're like their friends their parents' friends would come by and they would be playing all of these ouds and whatever, and just it's so hard to imagine what it's like to hear all that stuff. But I think we might have our Ariana back.
Yeah, hi guys, sorry. No. That's okay.
So let us
continue. Anyway, I guess ultimately, like all of a sudden, the shift. Like, I think when the U.S. invaded Iraq, it took a lot. It was a really crucial moment for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and a lot of attention was taken away again. And I think that's how the Taliban started regaining control. Anyway, that's another story. But it definitely the climate had shifted, and that's why I felt the urgency to go when we went. We went in June of 2007. And, I don't know, it was a natural progression. It was something that I had always wanted to do since I was a kid, and then all of a sudden I saw the window of opportunity closing. I was like, wait a minute, like, there may be, I won't be able to bring my band here pretty soon. And the truth is now I would not feel safe bringing my friends there. I would go there, but I just, with all of the protests that have been happening lately and everything. So we went in this very special moment, and we had it was really challenging. Everything you can imagine went wrong trying to record in a country that, like, you don't have the same energy situation that you have here where you flip on a light switch and we take it for granted that you're always going to have power. In Afghanistan, not every family has electricity, and even though we had electricity, it's like, the power goes out in Kabul at the time. I haven't been there in about 2 years, so I don't know how it is right now. But, the power would go out all the time. And we had a generator, and then the generator blew, and it's just like, oh, man. Our band was fighting, like, it was just so much stress, and I'm like, oh, my God, we can't go anywhere, we have guards, and...
You guys had guards while you were recording?
Oh, yeah, I mean, we had guards 24/7 out front. I mean, we were in a compound, basically, like, we were at my parents' house, but we had, like, it was like, we were protected, because that's just the situation. I mean, it's also had to do with my dad's position there, with his work, and the fact that I had, well, they always have guards, but the fact that I had American friends there with me, I definitely felt extra cautious, more so than I would on my own, just because, they're my friends. I brought them there. I would never want anything to happen to them. And And, you know, we took extra precautions. So I didn't feel safe. Like, we couldn't just, it's like you're recording an album in L.A. and you're annoyed with your bandmates. You can, like, go for a walk. We couldn't go for a walk. And this is for 3 weeks, you know, this is like practically a month indoors like that. With everything going wrong.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Afghani musicians you played with? A little bit just about that whole thing about having music banned is such a – and I know that you were saying it wasn't banned at that point, but just what kind of things they were going through. Like, you know, they come from this, you know, tradition. They play a lot. And then suddenly, like, their whole not just livelihood, but their whole kind of, you know, aesthetic vocation is challenged. And it's just so hard to even imagine that. What was their situation like?
You know, their stories were really, you know, beautiful and heartbreaking. Because these men, they're masters of their instruments. And one of them was 88 years old. He's considered to be, like, the last living master of his instrument, the Dil Rubah, which translates to of the heart. He was really special. This man had, like, he was just the most beautiful soul. And he had a Dil Rubah that his father had given him when he was growing up, and his father taught him. And during the time of the Taliban, he was moving his family to a safer location, and there was like a checkpoint, and he had dismantled it so that you could barely recognize it, but a soldier had recognized it, and he said, "Oh, I'm building one for somebody," and the man just, like, you know, was going to destroy it, and he's like, "Please, you know, please," like, begged him not to, and he just smashed it in front of him. And this is like, you know, you don't necessarily hear those stories. It's like we hear about women and children, but you know, this is a man who's like a distinguished, master of his instrument, a man he was probably in his like 70s when this happened. So it's like, that's just heartbreaking. And they had many stories like that where, you know, some musicians buried their instruments in the ground or hid them, or, you know, to have no music for that period of time, you know, no, children couldn't fly kites, little girls couldn't go to school. It's just a very, you know, it's I grew up hearing stories of a very different Afghanistan. The Afghanistan that my father grew up in and my aunts and uncles was so vibrant and forward, very advanced for that region, like one of the most advanced countries in that region. So to hear how far back it was taken because of all, you know, because of war and foreign policy and these other things that just sort of happened in the course of history there is what moved me to do this, to make an album there. And now, and I've been making this documentary as well.
What are you focusing on with the documentary?
The documentary has been a really organic process. Again, like, I didn't realize I was making a documentary. It was documenting Afghanistan with everyone saying, "Ariana, make a documentary, make a documentary." And my first trip, I was just like, sorry if it gets loud. I have to, like, let a bandmate into our rehearsal space. My first trip, I didn't want to make a documentary. I wanted to absorb it. It was my first time going there, and I felt so much love for my culture, and I wanted to be respectful and really take it in. But then I just, like, photographed and I filmed my trips, not knowing what the documentary would have been about. And then as time progressed, like, when I decided to record there, a friend of mine was like, "Oh, I'm going to come with you and we should make a documentary about it." And then I was like, "Oh, that's what my documentary is about. I'm going to make a documentary about recording an album." So we documented that whole process. And when we came back, I was like, wait a minute. You know, I've been interviewing my parents for the past 4 years about Afghanistan. And maybe you should see these tapes, because maybe there's some interesting information. So she watches these tapes of my parents, and she's like, "What? Wait a minute. This is fascinating. Like, your film is not just about your album. Your film is about your family. So I was like, oh, my God, you're right. I was interviewing them because I was going to write a screenplay about them. And so I had been making it all along. I had been, you know, organically making this documentary and putting all this work into something and not realizing I was already doing it. And then it was just about getting the missing pieces. So the film is about my life paralleling the war there. And it's about my family story, particularly my father's story, the story of my grandparents, my mom's parents and how they met, my mom's father coming, you know, immigrating over to the United States on a boat from Afghanistan in the 20s and marrying my Sicilian grandmother. It's about my father's, you know, involvement in the peace process and politics of Afghanistan since the Soviet invasion and the work he's been doing to reconstruct the banking system there. And it's about my own journey as an artist and as an Afghan-American growing up in all of this and how that's affected my work, my art, and the making of my album.
Well, that sounds great. You know, we're coming up on a break here, and before we go, I want to give our listeners a taste of your music. So I downloaded the Be Gone Taliban, and I don't know if you want to say anything about like that particular track before we'll listen to it, and then we'll take a break here and hear some announcements on the Progressive Radio Network, and then we'll be back after those announcements. But before we hear it, anything you want to say about that track?
Sure. I don't know. I had this dream that you can hear about in the song. But I had a dream, and then I woke up the next day, started writing the song with my bandmate, and then it, you know, we recorded part of it in Afghanistan with the Afghan musicians. We brought it back. My friend Carlos Nino came on board at one point in the production process, and he's like, "Oh, this needs strings, and I know the perfect person." And then my friend Miguel Atwood Ferguson arranged the strings. And it's been a big collaborative process to make that song, and I actually just directed a music video for it that's coming out really soon.
Great. Well, let's hear the track, and then we'll be back after the break.
To the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, the Progressive Radio Network.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the expat files. Nos vemos.
I kissed a smile upon her face.
For the most incisive analysis on the state of our planet from a black left perspective, join me, Glenn Ford, and my colleague Nellie Bailey at Black Agenda Radio, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you the full scope of reality as we and our interlocutors see it every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Black Agenda Radio, the place to get oriented to the black left worldview on the Progressive Radio Network.
A state of emergency. No, it's not. It's more of a state of urgency. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. I'm on the radio Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, offering a different narrative to the news, challenging what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're reading, offering another way of understanding what's going on. Join me online on MediaChannel.org and join me here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com Fridays at 1 p.m. Be there or be square.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Just sounds amazing to me, you know, the sense that they had about what was happening to the culture and how they were relating to you. I mean, what did they think about you, this crazy girl coming from California to make music in a gated home in the midst of all this strife?
Wait, what was the what? Sorry, I can't hear very well over here.
I was just asking more about what it was like to engage with the musicians. I mean, what did they think about you coming from California to make this record?
You know, I guess I can never really know what they thought because I don't know. I don't know if as human beings we ever. I don't know. It's like they were very sweet and they were very. I'm sure at first it was kind of funny, you know, but Max and Paloma, who came over there with me, are both really lovely people, and all three of us were so excited to work with them and play with them that I'm sure it was a little weird at first, like, you know, thinking about, like, okay, we have a language barrier, we're just going to jump into these songs and see where they go, you know, but it was actually very natural. In fact, the hardest songs to work on were with them. I had, like, two songs that were sort of covers of Afghan songs. One didn't make it to my album, but one that's called Chashma Siyah Dadi, like, it was a very famous song that I covered, but I kind of changed in my own way. And they really wanted to play it the old way, which took away from, like, I feel like, what I had done with it. So we kept trying to work on it with them, and it ended up, the recording with them didn't make it to my album. Actually, the recording that made it to my album, that song is the one I just did alone with Max, because it had its own vibe. And when we tried to do it with them, they really wanted it to be, like, the original. So that was actually the only hard song working on with them. Everything else,
that I had written and that had, like, more Western-sounding guitars in it or whatever was way easier for them to jump in on for some reason, maybe because they had no idea, you know, preconceived idea of how the song would go. And then they taught us this other traditional, you know, this Afghan song, this Ahmed Dayer song called Laili John, which was so much fun to learn, and that was totally their, you know, them jumping in and being like, learn this song, and we're like, okay, it's so, so awesome. So, yeah, so musically it was actually pretty organic and easy, and we were just, we just tried to be very polite and considerate, and we had a translator, and, you know, I think they have a lot of respect for my dad, yeah, and what he's been doing there, and
well,
they already
that.
Have a friendship with him.
Ian, on the flip side, how were you met with it in the United States? Like, to do an album during that time, especially, like, going back to Afghanistan after 9/11 and confronting that in the U.S., did you meet with any, like, adverse reactions, or did people judge you, or did you get any racism?
No, I didn't. I think everyone thought it was really amazing. I mean, I think my bandmates' families were pretty worried. I think they were a little like, huh? Especially my friend Paloma's family, I think they were kind of like, huh? You know, it's not safe. What are you doing? But she just loves culture and travel and studied ethnomusicology. So, I mean, both of my bandmates were so on board. They were like, immediately, like, yes, I'm going. So I think they faced some people saying, what, you're really going to do that? But I've been going since 2002, so people in my life are used to it as part of my life. And, you know, I always send all these massive emails back from my trips. And I think they all kind of just, I feel like everyone in my life is on the journey with me. I don't feel like I'm, like, the only person, just because I'm physically the one going over there and making the music or making the film or doing the thing. I feel like it's a caravan, and everyone in my life is part of the caravan. That's how I want it to be, and that's how it continues now. Like, I just did this music video for Beyond Taliban. Like, all my friends, like Miss KK and Mecca Vizy Andrews, and my friend Jimmy Fusel, my friend Rachel Fleischer, like, all of these friends of mine worked on it with me. So it's like this massive collaborative process that, but I'm also surrounded by really conscious people. I like to surround myself with people who are very open-minded. So I, you know, maybe I haven't heard the remarks that could be negative.
Hello? Hello? Where'd Eric go? I mean, that's fantastic. I think that because all we hear is a lot of stories of Afghanis in the U.S. that were, like, you know, they had their houses burned down or, like, people totally protested them. And so, I mean, I think it's very awesome that you didn't meet with any of that, and kind of amazing, and maybe just a testament to how far just keeping your mind open can go, and that what you were trying to do was really, you know, kind of have that experience of your own culture without divorcing it or being ashamed of it or having to hide it as your identity in Los Angeles. You know, you're actually able to bring those two things together, which, I mean, I don't know that there's very many people that can really do that successfully.
Well, it's interesting. I think I'm blessed, and I think the blessing is that, you know, because, as I said before, my mom is American. She's Afghan and Sicilian. So automatically, like, we already have another culture in our family, and my cousins are everything you can imagine. My parents are very educated and open-minded people. They're very peaceful, like, you know, open-minded people, and very progressive in their thoughts, and always have been. So I was raised in that, and, you know, we never faced prejudice ever, really. I mean, maybe in a minor way growing up, because it was just such a Caucasian town and everyone was Christian in my town. But I really feel like my friends thought it was cool. Like, they'd come over and listen to my dad tell these long stories about Afghanistan, or they thought my mom was such a character. And I was lucky. I feel like I have other Afghan friends who grew up with Afghan parents in very Afghan conservative families, where the culture was kind of pushed on them a little more. And I feel a lot of empathy about that, because I understand why certain immigrants, and it's not just Afghans, like people from other cultures that come here, you want to preserve your culture, and you want your children to speak your language and carry on the same sort of beliefs and values. But what can happen is sort of the opposite, I think, if you push something on someone. So I got lucky. The flip side of all of this is, I mean, as much as, you know, I know that people appreciate what I do because of me being me and being like sort of an amalgamation of these different things, like there are, I'm sure, young Afghans who are shocked and just don't, and like don't like me or something because I'm also very American, you know, but that's just who I am. Like, I'm definitely not going to apologize for it. And I'm very careful, like, and try to be very respectful. But, you know, I am two things. I'm not just one. And I'm more than that. I don't even just define myself by, like, you know, being Afghan-American. Like, I relate to so many cultures and belief systems and things. Like, I like all of it.
Can you give us a sense of, like, you were talking before about, like, the way you, like, the Afghanistan that your father grew up in and that he talked about, and I think that's also something we don't hear, you know, enough about. We always hear about places when they're tragic, and the one thing that I know about Afghanistan, you know, they talk a lot about the drug trade and, you know, the opium. The you know, all the farmers who are growing poppies, but they don't mention that, you know, Afghanistan used to be, you know, have some of the best orchards in the world, and it was renowned for these incredible, you know, fruits that would come out of the place. But when those orchards get destroyed, they take years and years and years to grow up an orchard. So if you're a poor farmer and your orchard's been torched, you got the, you know, poppies will come up next year. So that's like an example where, like, you know, as a news consumer, you think, oh yeah, all those guys, they just grow drugs, blah blah blah, and you don't know about the beautiful orchards and the life that supported. That was there before. So, you know, what is your sense about, you know, what it was like, or what was lost, or what your, you know, even if it's still there in some ways, what that kind of earlier world was like?
Yeah, well, you know, my aunts and uncles and family, they were like, my aunts, for example, were, you know, teachers, and women could be lawyers and teachers and study, and they were in university, and they could wear whatever, you know, they were wearing. I have photos of my aunts in mini skirts, not like, you know, super short, but like above the knee skirts. This is in the 60s. You know, they were very fashionable. Like, if you look at pictures of people in Kabul in the 60s and 70s, they're very fashionable. They were like following European trends, and the king actually made a point of being very modern. I actually met the king. I was very lucky to be able to meet the king before he died. He died a few years ago, but I met him, and I met his daughters, the princesses, and they were really cool. Like, I was sitting there with them talking, and very forward. They were expecting, I believe, I don't know if I'm remembering this exactly correctly, but I believe that they're at the time expecting grandchildren that were going to be, you know, Italian and Afghan, and they were very, like, forward-thinking in general. That's the Afghanistan that my dad grew up in. People from all over the world were traveling to Afghanistan because of how beautiful it was and how, you know, the culture known for hospitality and celebration. It's very, like, loving, hospitable people who will give you everything they have if you're their guest. Now, if you cross them, that's another story. It's like, historically, that's a completely different story, but it was a beautiful, beautiful country, and yes, orchards, trees, the landscape, the buildings. When the Soviets invaded, there were so many landmines. You know, put in the ground, and that's a real shame. There's a lot of demining has happened since then, but there still are landmines. Bombs were put in toys so that children would pick up a toy and, like, lose their limb. That was very devastating. But actually, a lot of the destruction that I saw in Kabul that I was attributing to the Soviets, people were correcting me and saying, actually, a lot of that is from the Civil War as well. And a lot of that destruction, a lot of it I saw in Kabul because it, since it's the capital, it's like a lot of fighting over Kabul. But yeah, you didn't see all these like bullet hole ridden buildings and yeah, so much of the agriculture was destroyed. If you go in the north, like Panjshir, and on the way up to Panjshir, there's a lot of beautiful trees, and there still is a lot of that element in Afghanistan. We don't see that on the news. You know, if you go to Bamiyan or Bandi Amir, it's like the most beautiful place I've ever seen on earth. And there, I really didn't see any traces of war in Bamiyan or Bandi Amir. Maybe a little bit, but it was really, honestly, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And
it's so interesting because, you know, it just relates back to what Eric was talking about at the beginning of the show about the importance of history and context with these places and how media just drives everything so out of proportion. You know, if someone would go there and think it was all just Taliban related, that someone that had no connection to the history there. And I mean, just you as an individual being able to have a connection to your parents and grandparents who remember these other times in these places.
Yeah.
And I really feel like, you know, so many people just don't even talk to their family members or elders anymore. And that's how so much gets out of context, even just like in America. And when you can actually just hear your grandmother talk about what happened and what they went through, then you automatically get put into context almost, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's heartbreaking. I'll tell you. Well, first I have to back up. There is, there's actually a very obvious proof of destruction in Bamiyan, which was the destruction of the Buddhist statues by the Taliban.
Yeah.
I should have thought of that, but anyway, I just want to correct that. I'm a storyteller. Like, that's what I'm... that's my craft, and that's what I've spent my whole life learning. So I am fascinated by stories, not just my family stories. I go to my friends' houses, and I want to know their parents' stories. My friends get annoyed because every time I see them, I literally say, tell me a story, like constantly. Tell me a story. Tell me another story. What's happening? Wait, tell me. And they're like, you always say, tell me a story, because I want to know everyone's stories.
Yeah.
I think, you know, yeah, what's so heartbreaking for me is that young Afghans growing up in Afghanistan right now, I've seen a very different Afghan culture.
Hmm.
And that's dangerous. Like, they didn't grow up with these memories. Their ancestors could even be dead. Their grandparents who would sit there and tell them what it used to be like could not be here anymore because of the war or because of leading the country or because of whatever. So I feel like young Afghans growing up there, you know, if all they've seen is war, and that's just heartbreaking. And not just Afghanistan. There's other countries where children right now have only seen war. And,
sure.
And that's very frightening for me to think of, like, child soldiers or people who have this skewed understanding of their own culture because of what they had to grow up in. And I think that's something that our generation has a huge job in shifting. We're going to have to give a lot of love to these young, you know, brothers and sisters in other countries that have such a skewed perspective. We're going to have to find ways to heal that because older generations are leaving us. And, you know, we're going to have to find ways to communicate that and shift that.
Yeah, I think that's great about telling your own stories. I mean, at the beginning I was talking about that. I think, you know, in some ways that's one of the best ways we have of breaking down the kind of, you know, real sort of simplified and often overly negative views we have about the world and other places. And so, you know, I'm often surprised. You know, I know as much of my family history as I can do relatively easily. I mean, you know, before you start getting into really nerdy kind of like deep research that's actually kind of very time consuming. It's often very difficult. But, you know, I love my family stories, and I'm surprised how many people don't, you know, especially, you know, some people have kind of like not that amazing. I mean, everybody's got interesting stories there, but some people who have incredible, their parents were, you know, moving from here to there, or they had to flee a war, and they met in a refugee camp or whatever. And they're like, but they're just like, they're just interested in what's happening now. And I think that's a real, danger in a way, that it's really important to, like, you know, tell the stories, because everybody's always interested in the story. You know, everybody's always ready to hear a story about love and loss and frustration and breakthrough. And if their stories are based on people's own backgrounds, on their family histories, you know, it's a link between now and before. And right now it's so easy to get caught up and lost in the now, because there's so much going on. We're so pressured by kind of the current world. So it just seems really, really key to do that. But I had a question for you about the Taliban. I mean, I know the Taliban is a very complicated thing, and there's lots of politics and theology and da-da-da-da. But, I mean, how do you see them as both part and not part of, you know, Afghans' history? It's, you know, like, are they just a complete aberration, or is there an aspect of your sense of the history and of the culture where you could almost see why something like that would happen? You know, does it seem foreign, or does it actually seem kind of like, you know, something else that's been going on, or it's been part of
it? No, it's,
you know,
definitely foreign. I mean, the Taliban wasn't even born of Afghans. It was like other countries' political agendas creating this regime that took, the reason why, like, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were able to be in Afghanistan, because there was no government at the time. It was like after the Soviet withdrawal and the Civil War, it was like just this lawless land, this open wound. That's like there's nothing to stop some regime from coming in and taking over. So it wasn't born of the people. It was born of surrounding countries' foreign policy and agendas, and also bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and all of that. So it really actually is not of Afghan culture at all, really. Now, there are Afghans in the Taliban, but when you're talking about little boys in refugee camps and, you know, recruiters coming into a refugee camp and saying to a mother who can't even feed, you know, a widowed mother who can't feed her children, we'll take your son, but, he, you know, we'll feed him and everything, but he'll be with us. Well, what's she going to say? She can't do anything. So it's like these little boys that are brainwashed into this other way of thinking, and it's unfortunately become a big part of the culture. Now, there are Afghans now who are supporting the Taliban who weren't necessarily after 9/11. Well, because now it's been a mess, you know, after, like, as I was saying, I feel like when we invaded Iraq, it created a big problem, and you have years of broken promises and, you know, different people's agendas and mismanagement or disorganization and, you know, things. It's like, what happened over this decade? Like, I went and kind of had a little breakdown in 2009. I literally had a breakdown. I went there and I had this sort of coming of age moment where I'm like, wow, I've been coming here for 7 years. Why has it gotten worse? Like, what is the deal? Like, who's responsible for this lack of leadership? And, you know, I had to be pretty sensitive about it because my parents had been there for seven years, like, completely sacrificing their comfortable lives here and, like, completely missed their grandchildren growing up, and we're living not, I mean, it's not easy. I have friends living over there right now who are my age. Like, I have a friend named Farah who is, like, a baby who's over there. You know, it's like people who are living there, it's really not an easy situation, like expats who have gone back to try to help. It's really difficult, and there's clash of understanding, because if you're coming back there, you know, you're trying to do work there, but you have to, you know, for example, I was staying in this hotel there my very first trip, and I was there when, you know, this is right after 9/11, so everything's just shifting there. And they were trying to train these young Afghans to just work in the restaurant in their hotel. And it was really hard for them, not only because the Western standard of, like, what's acceptable in a restaurant is really different. But also because you add to that years of war and devastation and what they've been through as psychologically, as a culture, that for them to come up to par with what's considered Western standards so that internationals can come and invest in the country and boost the economy, you see something like that and you realize how complicated it is that, you know, even funds going over there and things, you know, going there to rebuild and fix things, my notion of reconstruction and development and, you know, change is so much quicker than how things can actually happen in places like that. And I kind of had this breakdown. I'm talking to expats and foreigners and aid workers and people there. They were like, Ariana, it has gotten better. You're not going to see it as quickly as you want to see it because you have a Western perspective. But we've been all working hard, and it is getting better, even though there is a mess here and there are problems and, you know, it's not perfect, but it's getting there. And it was so hard for me to accept that. And ultimately what I left with is like, you know, we really need to stop this destruction. We have to stop wars and destruction and fighting, because when you destroy something like that, where it took centuries to build it, you can't just rebuild that. It takes so much. And that's what we're watching now is like, what I've finally came to see is like, you know, I can get upset about certain things and how certain things are run there or how people are leading in certain ways, but ultimately it's a huge task, and it's like you try to fix one problem, but there's a million problems around it. Like, they're all interrelated, and you add to that, you know, like you were saying, like drugs, for example. The other day I was just thinking about, you know, there were never addicts in Afghanistan. I mean, there were, I'm sure, but like, it was never a problem in Afghanistan that the Afghans were using drugs. They were exporting them for sure, but they weren't necessarily using them. And now it's a huge epidemic. And that just adds to the problem. Like, how are people going to work and rebuild their country if they're addicted to drugs? It's like, it's so complex. So, I mean, I guess the thing that I'm learning is, like, I don't have answers or solutions to all of it, but we really have to look at our destruction of the planet, because it takes a lot to rebuild.
Yeah, that's the thing that I remember. I mean, I really remember that point about orchards, because I just never thought about that. Just like the amount of time it takes to grow back the trees that create the beautiful place changes the whole picture. And so I think that's a really great call to go out on. We've got to wrap it up here, so I want to let people know they can go to arianadelawari.com. Ariana, it's been great having you on the show, and good luck with your career and all that.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. What's that?
I don't know what that was. You know, we get the serious signals sometimes on this show, you know. Expanding mind, you know, you never know what's going to happen. So,
gremlins,
but anyway.
Around. Wait, I feel like there was one. Do I have a second to say one other thing that I feel like I should add?
Sure, just slap it on. You got like 30 seconds.
Okay. I also have to say, I am not sure how the notion of the Taliban is right now, because now I can't tell who's who. I just want to say that one thing. Like, I don't know what it means anymore, because it's shifted because of all this American war and all of that stuff. So I just want to add that one thing, that I'm still trying to learn what the solution is.
Yes, it's very confusing. History is a dense and complex game. this is Eric Davis with Majid Abu on Expanding Mind. Keep your minds open.